Hey, this is Mitch Lloyd, and this is the 17th episode of the Gaslight Podcast. Today, we're joined by Chris Glass, a versatile technical designer and Cincinnati resident. We adjusted the mic stand as high as it would go for Chris.
There you go.
Oh, great. Now I have to sit up.
And brought Gaslight designer Kristen Lasita in to lend her design perspective.
Oh, really?
Chris had recently given a presentation at QC Merge. I was impressed that it was one of the first public talks he'd given.
It was the second time I spoke.
The second time, but that was like the same talk?
I added some stuff.
Okay.
But yeah, essentially it was the same basic framework of was started with crowns and now here I am.
So, right.
Yeah, it was the same idea. I added a little bit of stuff and
you call crayons crowns, is that?
Crayons. I practiced that for a while. It's like crowns, crayons, crowns. You know, it just went over and over. And it was, so I'm trying to say it right.
Yeah.
It doesn't always work.
Well, the thing that was super impressive just like visually was, I think it was probably the first time you did it, was the Making a World book. When you had the page on the screen,
right.
You know, everyone's expectation is that it's a static image. And then you turn the page and it just kind of gave it this whole like life that was just like, amazing. Was that something you'd done before in presentations or was that
something
you decided to do?
That was probably the first time I used Keynote in earnest.
Really? Man, that's killer.
Well, I mean, it's you know, it's Apple software, so it made it really easy to just drag in a video. I didn't know how it would perform. I was really pleased that you could add text over a video. So that was kind of a nice surprise because it really starts to mess with your mind where it's like, oh, that is a flat image, but then you can have movement.
Yeah.
The more subtle it is, the more effective it is, I think.
Yeah.
The second time I spoke. And where were your questions during that? Because nobody had questions.
I was just in awe. I was just sitting there just trying to soak it in. And
I figured it might be a barrage, you know. 275 slides can be a lot to
yeah, but it almost also felt like a performance. You know, some people get up there and talk and it's just kind of like, hey, I just got these things to say. And this was just like so, I don't know, it was so like linear and like put together in this format. I don't know, maybe it was a little bit intimidating for like a conversation, like sparking a conversation.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It was like the end of the story. It was like,
yeah,
you told a story and it was over and I didn't want to go any further.
Bam, drop the microphone. Yeah. I'm done.
Walk off stage.
Yeah. I did it that way mainly because I don't have experience talking. If I started to freak out, I could just go to the next slide and it would tell me what I was supposed to say.
Yeah.
So it was really just a bunch of cue cards that everyone got to see. So that was the idea.
Yeah.
I guess I wanted to bring this up just for people that weren't at any of your presentations, just kind of maybe recap what your path to becoming a designer and what you're doing now.
Sure. Yeah. So I gave a talk at Queen City Merge and then Creative Mornings, both a week apart. And, you know, I really, in the talk, I talk about, presentation should be like facts and figures and, you know, it should learn you something. And you should really not tell your personal story so much or not belabor it. And so, of course, my whole talk is my personal story.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts by, I talk about growing up in a really creative family and kids' books that taught me to draw, then how I learned how to draw in college. And then, you know, it probably all stems from Super Mario and Pixels and got into CD-ROMs and web design, and here I am.
And those CD-ROMs, by the way, like, for some reason, my dad we got a computer early on, and that was like the only thing he could do is buy CD-ROMs.
Yeah.
And he was like, well, I got this computer, so it's going to be so educational for everyone. And he had all these educational things. I recognized like those columns and things. Like, we had that CD-ROM.
And then there was Encarta, which had a nice flat style, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. So I had those CD-ROMs, and looking at those was like so nostalgic to see those.
It was, they were fun to do at the time. It's funny, you know, they're 640 by 480 was your canvas. And it was, you know, in some ways it was a little bit more liberating than what we have now because we have so many options. It was nice to have those constraints.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you could – fonts weren't such a big issue unless it was live type that was data driven. So anyway, it was really good training wheels for interface design, I think. It was kind of like, here's a very specific sandbox in which to explore – interface.
Yeah. And one thing that popped up there that seemed like a theme that I loved was the idea of taking something like analog in the real world, like you took the columns and
right.
I think you made those and took a picture of them.
Yeah.
And then brought them instead of like, you know, digitally designing it. And I don't know. I think that, I don't know. I feel like that came up a few times, and yes. I kind of thought back to listening to someone talk about like doing sound design on WALL-E or something. Mm-hmm. And they had the same thing where they don't start with anything digital. They start with like all analog sounds and then kind of mess with it on top. I mean, is that something you continue to do or?
Oh yeah. Mostly because I don't know how to use 3D software.
Okay.
So really this signature is, It's just my limitations.
It's like a constraint.
Right. But, you know, it's much easier to just print out some columns and take a photo of those or, you know, go to Michael's and buy 3D letters and just throw them on a table. You know, it's and there's something I think really, really rewarding about stepping away from the computer.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. So I don't intentionally do it, but if I don't step away from the computer for a period of time, I get a little antsy and – it's always a relief to just kind of play a little bit and use your hands and, you know, get them dirty and see what comes of it. So,
yeah,
I think it's, you know, it's harder and harder these days to do that because so many of the things that we have can be accomplished with just, you know, a keyboard and a mouse and mm-hmm. some code and what have you. So there's not a lot of incentive to go out and do that. But, you know, I tried this little... What is it? It's called the Pomodoro technique, and it's this tomato egg timer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's like you do some for 15 or 20 mm-hmm. minutes or so, and then you take a break and you kind of step away or what have you. It was really it sounded like a great idea, but I haven't got it to work yet. But
yeah,
it's, in theory, I need like a big extended Pomodoro technique to actually step away from the computer and just, all right, now spend 15 minutes doing something with – you know, a pencil or something. I don't know.
So is that how kind of your foray into screen printing came about? Is you need to step away from the computer, you need
totally.
A break?
Yeah. And I think, you know, and this is a difference between CD-ROMs and the web. With a CD-ROM, and sometimes that was a really bad thing, is you had to commit. You had to go to press, and it had to go out the door. There's no room for patches necessarily. Mm-hmm. And the opposite is with the web, where nothing is ever done.
Oh, yes.
So it's always evolving. So it's like you launch some stuff that you've been working on, and then all of a sudden, you know, the team starts working on it, a greater team, and maybe, you know, it starts to degrade, and it's just not the intention of what you had set out to do. And over time, that gets worse and worse and worse. And I think screen printing, going into that was a way to say, okay, this is the intention and I'm going to stop right here and it's not going to fade. Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully it won't fade.
Well, fade in an artful way.
Yes, exactly. It's that nice patina you're always looking for that makes things look lived in. Yeah. So that was the idea, is it's like, man, this sucks. Everything is ruined,
you know? Right?
So we started with the t-shirts, and really it was just because my partner at work, Tom, and I, we love bands, we love going to concerts, we're always buying t-shirts, and it was just a way to say, you know, let's do some of that, and we got better at it over 2 years.
Well, that's something that Kristen was talking to me about, like how do you mm-hmm. know when something's done? You know, like there. So in a digital world, even if you're designing something before you put it on a t-shirt, at some point, you know, you iterate on it and you iterate. And how do you know when it's done? Is it just a deadline that's coming up? That's how much time I had.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know when it's done, or do you just get sick of it?
Yeah. That's a good one, because it's generally, I feel like it's really apparent when something is done. You know, you just mm-hmm. it's a feeling where you're just like, all right, step away. The deadline, though, is our best motivator. I think some mm-hmm. of our better projects have come because we set a deadline.
Right.
And sometimes it's arbitrary. Like when we launched our store online, we were like, okay, we need to have like 6 products and we're going to launch by Christmas, and that's that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that pushed us to get some stuff done. In the past, there's been, you know, the OTR 5K, which is a run that happens downtown. And, you know, they used to have a vendor set up around it, and now it's part of the City Flea, I think, is set up during it. But we were like, oh, we're going to set up this event and sell some shirts. We have a week. What can we do?
Mm.
So generally we find our best stuff happens under really tight constraint. You know, I think another part of being kind of in control over the entire process from design to production is it gives us that relief that we don't have to be done. You know, a good example is we had the shirt that said, enjoy this beautiful day. And then on the bottom it said in small type, because we get so few of them. And so that was the shirt we did. We ran with it. We did it for a while. And then some people came up and, you know, talked to us and they said, you know, that's kind of a weird subline to
like,
have.
A little morbid.
That's a little dark. Maybe you don't need to go there. So we're like, all right, let's just tape that part off the screen and print another batch. And so we do that where, you know, there's this iterative approach where we'll do something and then we'll get feedback and then we'll just sell it again. So then you have a collector's item.
The first edition.
Exactly. So so it's and it's kind of funny as, you know, it's the whole idea of T-shirts and printing, screen printing was to have something that was done. And now we're finding, oh, well, we can still change. So no rules ever apply, essentially, is the rule.
Because that's something I've been struggling with, making the transition from doing print design where it was, I sent it to the printer, it's done. I can't change it. There's a million of them. It's fine. And then coming to this where it's just I can constantly sit there and go back. Oh, I can tweak that. I don't quite like where that button is and move it. And I struggle with that concept of this is done. I need to leave it be.
Right. Fiddling's fun, though.
That's true. Until it gets to the point where it's way too much.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you more about the way you work. One thing that I thought was interesting is just looking at your photography and stuff during the presentation. It seems like you're a fan of being out like in some kind of isolation, like the farmhouse place that you are. And obviously, as you know, a lot of designers want to be in like a city with like lots of people around and, and all that sort of thing. Is that like something that you do purposely, that you like sort of these more remote work styles, or you know, is that something that just is incidental?
No, I think it's serendipity, but I will say that I think what works for me and what I really like is balance. So I live in the city and I work in the country.
Okay.
And,
interesting.
You know, if we move to the city, I would probably look for a place that was a little bit more quiet to live. You know, I think having that contrast is – it fuels the spirit. You know, when I come home, it's there's never a loss of things to do now in Cincinnati. It's just kind of ridiculous.
It's awesome,
in a good way. So, you know, I have this really active life at night. But then when I drive out to Oxford, it's this serene kind of great place to focus and relax. And there is no noise. You know, it's, you know, it's birds chirping. And you don't have people coming to the door and knocking on it or, you know, lunch is a really simple affair because there's just not that many places to eat. So, you know, when you eliminate all this distraction, you're able to really focus and do your work. Now, conversely, if we would, you know, there's thoughts that we'd like to have more – a bigger space. So, you know, if we would change that, you know, how would I then achieve that balance again? And I don't know the answer to that, but I do think it's important to have, you know, even if it's just a distinction between your workspace and your life space. Like that was the one reason why I drove to Oxford for a few years. I was working from home, and that was just a super bummer because it was like, I don't know, just going crazy, you know, sitting at home all day long and not having any change of perspective. It was maddening. So I was glad to drive 45 minutes to Oxford because it's a reverse commute and that's kind of mellow and it's reverse commute on the way back as well. So,
I mean, do you have people around you when you work? Do you have like music playing or do you
Have music? It's a constant fight. but essentially,
we know that fight pretty well.
Tom and I are the only two during the day, the day to day. Every once in a while, we'll get a few more folks in to help us print. But for the most part, it's just us two. So, Wendy is our third partner. And she just began teaching, actually not just began, it's been a couple years now teaching Montessori. So she's out of the space, but she's still our third vote and, there in spirit and making sure we don't do really bad ideas of which we come up with often.
Do you feel like you've always done your best work with partners? Or, I mean, it seems like maybe early on you were working alone. And then it seems just, again, from watching the presentation that you kind of like paired up with these people and had these really strong working relationships that you just carried forward? I mean, is that like a really important piece of your work to you, to have somebody that's like a trusted partner like that?
Sure. When it comes to like design projects, I really feel like the best stuff comes from partnerships. And, you know, it's not necessarily a competitive streak, but I really feel that it's cooperative. And, you know, for me, design is very much, all right, you have the idea and let me help you express it. And, you know, that comes in a variety of forms, whether it's a client, an organization, a big group, or I don't know if you've ever seen layer tennis. It's this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I've done that a few times.
Oh, really?
But it's this really great way of kind of feeding off each other and throwing ideas on the wall and seeing what sticks and running with it. Mm-hmm. And I find that I prefer that for the most part, just professionally and jobs. And I like those perspectives to be diverse. Yeah. I think the more diverse, the more exciting it is. And I feel like I'm always in school and learning and kind of approaching things as, you know, it's like, okay, I don't know anything. Tell me what you're trying to say and let me then try to combine it in some way that can communicate it to other people that are, you know, as clueless as I am. So I wouldn't say I like to work alone at all, but I do have some things like, you know, my personal site. I take photos and stuff, and that's a very deeply personal thing where I don't like to take direction at all on that. And I mean, I like feedback and all, but I don't do that as a collaboration. It's really just this personal kind of look at each day, and then I move on from there. So,
what are the main things that you're working on now? Is it mainly the t-shirts, or is it just a huge swath of projects all the time?
Oh gosh, it's a ton. Yeah. Let's see. I'm currently working on a video for a client that will describe their business. You know, these are kind of popular things now to have these explainer videos.
Right.
And I really like it because it's a combination of so much that I like. You know, it's motion and graphics and story and visuals. You know, it's a really concentrated thing that, you know, they are a lot of work. What I also like about it is I can do it myself. I don't need a big team to actually create a video, so I can work all the pieces and make it happen. So that's on my plate this week. And in the side, I've got a few websites that are being coded. So I work with other people that do development, and then that's an iterative process of back and forth. You know, then we have the t-shirt stuff, which I've got a list in my head of stuff I need to be working on. But I think it's that old saying, the cobbler's children have no shoes. it's hard to dedicate time to that. So, you know, I keep saying to Tom, I'm like, okay, after this week, then I'm going to have time.
Yeah.
And I've said that a few weeks now, maybe like 50.
Yeah. So, it seems like something we struggle with too. We've got internal projects and it's like, now we're going to bang this out. Yeah. And then, but if anything else comes up, it just gets pushed to the side. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately. So it seems like you're in a position now where you, to some extent, can kind of just work on whatever you want in a way. I mean, is that fair to say? I think one question that I was thinking about is, you know, at what point did you feel that, you know, I've made it to a point where, you know, I'm not just scraping by to get the next job. Mm-hmm. I've got some kind of like, you know, autonomy to say, this is what I really want to do. I mean, did you feel like always you were that way, or is there a certain point you knew, like, okay, now I've got enough traction that I'm, you know, I can kind of pick and choose things?
Right. I should have asked if we could cuss beforehand.
I'm not gonna cut it out.
I'm not gonna. I feel like I've often, you know, I've been this way for a while, where I'm really passionate about the projects I take on, I don't feel like I'm at this place where I can just pick and choose. Like, I do feel like I do stuff for work, but I do feel very lucky that everyone I work with, I really like. Mm. And, you know, that makes, you know, doing stuff for a paycheck feel really good.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I try to work hard enough where I can then play hard. So, you know, it's kind of just kind of a balancing act of, okay, I work really hard for a while, or even just part of the day. And then I have enough time. I've invested enough in myself that I can take a little bit of time and do my own thing and explore personal projects or projects for Wire and Twine. So, yeah, I don't feel like I command any, you know, autonomy necessarily. It's just kind of a, you know, I do say yes too much. So I'm trying to work on that. But yeah, for the most part, it's kind of responding to what's out there. You know, I think there's always that dream of having a little bit of extra time and then making that list of, okay, what are the dream jobs that I want? And, you know, I have that, you know, I have a list on my phone that's growing and, you know, it's slow growing. But
so, okay, well, what are those dream jobs? I mean, so right now, some people would probably look at you and say, that is awesome. Like, he's got it made. Like, that's the dream job for a designer, you know, picking and choosing projects and just being really energized. But what is, like, the next level for you? Like, what is the perfect, here comes the phone.
Yeah, I don't know. I think sometimes.
Is it in the Notes app?
I use Wunderlist.
Like a to-do list?
It's just a list maker. So I use it for groceries and let's see. Just the categories are going to be fun here. Grocery list, that's number one.
That's really important.
To-do major, which has things like
big things I need to get done.
I think that one has like get buff on there. gifts to buy for people. Like if you ever see a gift and you want to buy it for somebody.
Yeah.
That's smart.
Places to eat. I currently have 50 places.
One called Places to Eat.
let's see. Movies I want to see. Music I want to buy. T-shirt ideas. Places to visit. Games to play. Drinks. Let's see what's in there. I need to get Blanton's apparently.
Yeah.
That's there.
It's got the little horse on top. It's delicious.
Is it a beer?
No, it's a whiskey.
Bourbon?
Or
whiskey?
Maybe I stopped saying bourbon because I had a friend that had made this huge distinguishing. I'm like, all right, I think whiskey's the bigger circle.
Sure.
With the little circle inside. So bourbon's, I always
like,
say whiskey.
Bourbon is to Kentucky, like champagne is to France.
Oh, right.
Nice analogy.
Is what I was told. I'm probably really wrong.
No, I think it's right.
Another category is tweets on scent, of which I don't tweet very much. So let's see. Oh, potential clients. So, you know, sometimes it's vague, like something in the entertainment industry. I don't know what that means. humanitarian, you know, I'd like to work for companies that are trying to improve lives. And I think that, you know, when we're in the tech industry, it's often easy to just kind of eat the dog food and say, oh, this is an app and it helps you make lists to figure out what to drink.
Yeah.
but, you know, what's greater than that? What's a greater good? And so I'm always kind of keeping my eyes peeled for individuals or organizations that are doing those things. So that's one. Another, you know, dream client is, you know, travel. I love to travel.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, why can't I get paid for that? You know, so that's the idea. You know,
yeah.
I have really lofty goals here. You know,
that's pretty nice. the thing you said about the tech community is like kind of a personal pet peeve of mine. I feel like there's like this super insular world of let's, you know, aggregate our followers and here's another list making app for you to publish a 6-second video. I don't know. There's like these very like social network focused little fiddly things when there's so many big problems in the world that need to be addressed.
Right.
That you could have such a bigger impact on.
But I want to see six seconds of my cat playing with the string. It's really important.
It's important.
You know, I think it, you know, all of that silliness can lead to something greater.
Right.
You know, for example, you know, diet tracking apps. I think that's really valuable to consider what you eat and all of that. But, you know, what if they would start to aggregate that data and then start to understand, oh, these people in this area are eating this food and they're having a higher rate of this disease. Mm. You know, I just wonder if there's something greater that comes of all of this fiddly nonsense.
Right. Like we could gather some data to make some real
changes. Since, you know, I think privacy is becoming less and less of an issue, sharing that you had a Hostess Twinkie or a kale chip might be easy to let go, and some geolocation data, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, nerds speak.
All right, Kristen, I'm going to make you ask this next question.
Which one? The highlight one?
I thought we were getting near the end. Yes.
What is it? This is the great question that I feel like I always want to ask. Any advice to the new designers out there that are just getting their feet under them?
Yeah. Let's see. it came out in the talk briefly, which is don't wait. But, you know, I think that we're at this really great place now where it's like, oh, I want to make T-shirts, or I want to make an app or a website, or I want to take a photo. You can now. And you don't have to wait to have that project fall into your lap. And by kind of preemptively just kind of tackling these things that you love, I think that the type of work that you really want will fall into your lap. So really, it's just a matter of, you know, and that's the hard part, actually, is to figure out what it is that you love.
Yes, exactly.
So, you know, there's certainly a lot of time for experimentation if you want. You know, I never really had a job. So I feel like when I got out of school, I started right into making CD-ROMs. So I was doing something that I loved from day one. So I never had to, like, I never worked in a big corporate office. I've always dreamed of that, where I could just go, like, clock in and go around the water cooler, and then at 5 o'clock I could leave. And
you've
then
dreamed of that fondly. Yeah.
I also want to be a server at a restaurant, just because it sounds like it's a really physical job.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's constantly changing.
These things are so attainable.
Yeah. You know, I think if you set your goals really low, you can win.
There you go.
Aim for the floor.
Yes. Aim. That's a good one. Aim for the floor. Anyway, yeah, I think young designers, and I think that they're doing it now, you know, where you don't have to worry about the projects that you were given in school. There's such a great opportunity to just kind of go, what do I really want to do? And, you know, and fail a lot. I think, you know, it's, and you can always hide it later and cover your tracks. You don't have to share those failures. It can just be a private personal thing. Anyway, and then when you feel good about it, put it out there.
So are you talking about like doing work for free? Are you talking about just doing your own work and just showing it to people? Is that what you mean?
Well, you know, the design community often gets all frustrated when spec work is brought up. But I have to say, some of my best projects came from spec work, but it wasn't like a contest or anything.
Right.
I approached them and I said, here's where you are with your website, and here's a plan of getting out of that and kind of thinking toward the future. And invariably, it always worked. And, you know, I got a client out of that that I really loved. So that is speculative work. But I also look at, you know, my early portfolios. It was just like, a good example is the Taft Museum in Cincinnati. They didn't have a website. I was doing CD-ROMs, and I'm like, that would be an awesome CD-ROM. Yeah. So I just made one just to show this is what you can do. And it turned into a lot of art-related projects.
Yeah.
So you know, I don't think it has to be necessarily speculative in terms of some type of a contest, but specific, yes, and put it out there, even if it is just to your desired audience. So in that case, I started with the Taft, and I'm like, hey, check this out. Mm-hmm. And they were like, oh, you know, our friends over at Artworks need something for the Big Pig gig. Go talk to them. And so we did. And, you know, it turned into a really nice project that lasted for many years. So,
yeah. No, that's funny. The first freelance client I had when I was still in school was a restaurant in Bloomington. And I just looked at the website and I was like, this is horrible. And I just made up a website and sent it to the guy and was like, hey, you know, want me to implement this thing, which I spent like a long time making this thing, right? That's totally speculative work. And he's like, oh, yeah, that's good. And like, I don't know, we had this great long relationship of working on his restaurant business and his website, and it was really cool. I mean, that was like my first thing, so I kind of took that same route. I guess if you really love to do something like that, it doesn't hurt to it doesn't hurt you to work on it, and you're getting better. I mean,
yeah, I always feel like people are always going out there, and they don't realize that their website probably isn't the best thing until you show them how awesome it can be. And then their mind's kind of blown. They're like, yes, I do want to put the time into this. I do actually want to do it.
And there are millions of really bad restaurant websites still out there today.
Oh, yes.
It's amazing. Yeah, and having a Facebook page is not enough, restaurants. Deal with it. You can have a link to Facebook on there, but just, you know, give me something on my phone. Make it happen.
Yeah.
Anyway.
All right. Well, it's totally awesome to have you on.
Thanks.
A great time. And
this was easy.
Yeah. Is there anything you want to like let people know? We don't have a huge audience, but I mean, is there anything that you want to plug, or are there places you're going to be speaking soon that people might want to come see you?
I have nothing. All right, you know, we'll we hope to make some new stuff in the future. That's my plug.
So just hit up Wire and Twine?
To wireandtwine.com, yeah. That's awesome. That's where we sell our goods. So it's sorely out of date. I don't want to talk about it. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Kristen.